My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. I was the overall chairperson of the Atlantic Group in 2008. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous or an organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Amanda, overall chairperson in 2011, will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, and I was your overall in 2011. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Jeffrey, overall chairperson in 2012, will read the steps.
My name is Jeffrey, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was the overall chairperson in 2012. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Vince, the overall chairperson in 2006, will read the traditions.
Hi, my name is Vince V. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, it was my privilege to serve as overall chair in 2006. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an alcoholic ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Brittany. Tonight is our group's 19th anniversary. For which we have a special format. Peggy will give us a brief history of the group, followed by an information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 45 minutes. Please help me welcome our co-founder and overall chair in 1995, Peggy.
Thank you, honey. Thank you. My name is Peggy Byrne. I'm an alcoholic. And now, the history of the Atlantic Group. Many groups start with a resentment and a coffee pot. The Atlantic Group did not. It started with a dream and some good examples, the enthusiasm of the Pacific Group and its founder, Clancy. And I was blessed with having been one of the founders, along with Van, who passed away 7 years ago, and whose loss to the Atlantic Group is incalculable. Van was, without a doubt, the Atlantic Group's shepherd. The fellowship we chose 19 years ago has grown up around our big book makes that promise. It was March 1st, 1994, and we met for the first time at the Convent of the Sacred Heart on Fifth Avenue and 91st Street. I had scouted the location and chose it because we would meet in the recital hall and the chairs were red velvet in gold gilt frames. They forgot they had rented the hall to us that first night, and their students were rehearsing a play in the theater, so we were put in the library, which held about 40 comfortably. And that first meeting, we were 75. In our fifth year, they asked us to hold our attendance to 75, that we were too big for the hall. And we were about 200 at that time. We couldn't do that, so we went on a search for a larger space. Thankfully, we relocated here to Christ Church, and very happily, may I say. Now, our meeting history of the actual meetings. On February 5th, we started our second meeting, a big book study, and now it meets at Gustavus Adolphus Church every Wednesday. On July 1st, 1998, our third meeting was our beginners meeting, which now meets at Holy Trinity on East 74th on Thursdays. On January 7, 2000, our fourth meeting, Steps and Traditions, was launched and meets at Fridays at the Universalist Church on the West Side. On October 13, 2002, we started our fifth meeting, a call-up. It meets Sundays at the School of the Future. On February 28, 2005, began our sixth meeting, the 11th Step Tradition and Meditation, and it meets Mondays at the Church of the Good Shepherd. On February 16, 2008, our seventh meeting, which is a two-speaker meeting, and it meets every Saturday at 6 p.m. at the Church of the Good Shepherd. Now, Van gave the history talk every year until he became too ill, and he asked me to take over. Here is what Van read on our 10th anniversary, and it is as relevant today as it was then. What has grown here is loyalty and responsibility to the home group and a sponsorship ethic which stresses AA's program of recovery, a desire to do service and to support our service branches with time and money. We have maintained the structure that we developed here, and as a direct result, we have flourished. But I will tell you why we are 10 years old. Enough of you are willing to give up for the time you spend at an Atlantic Group meeting, your personal desires, even your demands. You give up your individual, may I say, rights. That for at least while you attend an Atlantic Group meeting, you follow, consciously or not, the first tradition. The group comes first. The individual second, albeit a close second. That you are obedient, you are obedient to avoiding the use of street language. You dress according to our dress code. And following another tradition, our primary purpose, carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is you, the individual member, being loving and tolerant of your group, and that's what makes it work. It is because you make that sacrifice that we are here tonight celebrating 10 years. And if you keep that up, if you remain true to the group conscience, retain the structure, follow the traditions, especially Alcoholics Anonymous' singleness of purpose, you will meet 20, 30, maybe more years and fill this room with AA music, laughter, and the sharing of love for one another, our fellowship, and especially our group. Thank you.
Speaker tonight is Clancy.
My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I have never been a chairman of this group, but I founded the founder. I mean, I sponsored the founder, and I'm now Peggy's sponsor, so I have enormous influence throughout the area. I'm very glad to be here. I've been here. When Peggy started this meeting, Peggy and Van, and I kind of joked with them, I said, if you ever last, that goofy meeting ever lasts a year, I'll come in and talk at the anniversary. And it did, and I've been at every anniversary since, except 2 years ago when they opened my carotid artery and found a lot of nonsense in it that I'd planned to get rid of here. But I couldn't come. I was in the hospital. Now, this year, we have a famous speaker tonight. Sit down. last week I had a stent put in my heart, but the doctor said, are you going to take it easy? I said, no, they need me at the Atlantic Group. If you believe that, well, onward and upward. But anyway, I'm glad to be here tonight. I've had a wonderful visit, as I always do. I had a wonderful day today. I visited our friends at the World Service Office, and some of them are here tonight, judging me and holding up 3 and 4. But then I went up to the stepping stones and said goodbye to the woman up there who's administering. This is her last day. And had a good AA day. I'm very glad to be safe and sane and sober because I didn't used to be, and I may not be again sometime. There's always kind of poignant, you know, as the years go by. This is the first year that I can recall that my old friend Dan Fraser, an actor who's not up the balcony scowling at me, he passed away this year, which always happens to people. And a great many people that I know have passed away because I've lived a little too long. And people say, how come you live so long? Well, people you sponsor die. It took me a long time to think of the answer why I live so long. But I'll tell you why. Because the good die young. I may be eternal. But tonight, I've told my story here, I guess, 18 times. But tonight, someone suggested perhaps, because of the nature of the way AA is working around the country and the world, there seems to be a lot of stress on this. Why do we have this singleness of purpose? Why do they keep grinding us on the singleness of purpose? You know, I have to be an alcoholic. Read it tonight. You have to be an alcoholic to participate here. And why is that? If you're young and new to AA, you may not know why. And so I'm just going to talk for a few minutes on that subject tonight, since it's an anniversary and we can talk about whatever we want on our anniversary. But we all, most of us, know the story about Bill Wilson, this drunken goof that wound up in town hospital, and in his friends, Ebby and some others from the Oxford group, called on him and said, "Bob, Bill, you've got to find a power greater than yourself." He said, "I don't want to hear that religious crap. Don't give that to me." So they went home. But he woke up in the middle of the night, terribly afraid, his heart pounding, and he knew he was going to die. In fact, the doctor had called his wife and said, "This is his last trip here. He will never survive to have another one." And he woke up in a fear and he cried out, "If there's a God there, show yourself!" And he wrote later, the darndest thing happened. The lights came out of the room and yet nobody turned them on. There was a wind blowing through closed windows. And the one thing he knew was that I'm having a psychiatric breakdown and I'm going crazy. And but he felt good, and yet this strange thing was happening. And all of a sudden the lights went out again and the wind stopped. And he had a strange feeling of well-being. But he went, told the doctor about it in the morning. He said, "Doctor, did I crack up last night? Was that it? Did I have a psychiatric breakdown?" The doctor looked at him in the eyes and said, "No, you didn't, Bill. I don't know what happened to you, but whatever happened to you, hang on to it, because you're a different person today." Now, we have come to understand that probably he had a spiritual experience. And previous to that, Dr. Jung in Europe had described alcoholics as being people who either had to have a spiritual experience or they had to keep themselves confined for the rest of their life. But he had a spiritual experience. He didn't know what it was, but he knew he felt differently. And he remembered the guys from the Oxford group, Ebby and those people, so he went to the Oxford group meeting and he took it all in. Let me tell you what the Oxford group was, just for the fun of it. A lot of people don't know. In 1908, a Lutheran minister in Pennsylvania, felt that Christianity was getting too loose. You know, in the old days, they'd be glad to be crucified for their faith or burned alive, but now you couldn't even get them to go to church if it rained. And they just not... So he started an organization with dedication. He called it the First Century Christian Association. Be prepared to do anything for your faith. And not a lot of people turned out, you know. "I don't think I want to be crucified this year, Reverend, but I'll keep in touch." And after the First World War, he went to England and tried to talk it up. And not very many people were interested at all. But of all things, the students at Oxford University thought it was just wonderful. "Oh, look at this wonderful movement. We'll all get in it." So much so, they changed the name of it to the Oxford Group. And he brought it back in the late 1920s. And by this time, he had the support of the Oxford group, which had a certain intellectual panache. So there were Oxford groups all over the country all of a sudden. And what they evolved into doing was be people, kind of nice people, upper-class people, well-to-do people, meeting in one another's homes once a week and discussing how they could get better contact with God, their God. And they felt that once they had a connection with their higher power, then they had to augment that. And that's what Ebby had been trying to tell Bill about, and Bill didn't want to hear it. But he went to the Oxford group and got involved in this and got enjoying it very much. And he felt what that experience was in the hospital. "I must have a calling to help drunkards. That's what it was. I have a calling to help drunkards." And so he began helping drunkards. He lived over in Brooklyn, came over to Manhattan for most of his Oxford group meetings. And he'd pick up street drunks along the way, old, dirty, scurvy, smelly, And bring them to these nice meetings and these little old ladies, you know. I believe you're vomiting on my shoe, sir. But he'd bring them in there and try to tell them what he tried to do with these people was communicate with them how to have a spiritual experience so they could feel the way he felt. And he'd bring them home at night sometimes. He had one guy commit suicide in his house over in Brooklyn. He had a terrible time. Nobody stayed sober. And after 6 months of this, he got up one morning and he realized that the guy he brought home last night apparently had stolen the coffee pot to sell for wine. And he looked at his wife putting on her sweater. She had been a chic society girl when he met her. Now she's old before her time with salt and pepper hair and not much fashion, and putting on her sweater with a patch on the sleeve so she could go work in the basement of this cheap department store so at least they'd have enough money to pay the rent while he helped alcoholics in vain. And he had a terrible wave of remorse. He said, Lois, I'm so sorry. I thought I had some kind of a calling to help drunkards, but I haven't. Not one person has stayed sober. They come with us, they steal our stuff. I've tried to do the best I could, but I was wrong entirely. I see that now. I'm going to quit doing this, and I'll get a job tomorrow if it's shoveling dirt, but I'm going to get you out of that damn department store, and we're going to start to have a life. And I'll tell you something, my friends. At that moment, your life and mine hung by a thread about that big. We were just about extinct. And she turned to him and said something that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her at a convention up in Connecticut about 40 years ago. And I said, Lois, how did you ever think of that great answer? My God, you changed our lives. She said, I don't know, it just seemed obvious to me. He said to me, nobody has stayed sober. And she said, you did. She said, oh, yeah. That's why old timers don't have much hair in front. You just go through a, oh, yeah. And so he decided to start again, but knew he was doing something wrong. None of them had ever had a spiritual experience like he tried to invest in them. So he went back to Towns Hospital, his old doctor friend down there, and explained this to him. The doctor, he says, I can't get these people to have any kind of a spiritual experience. They got to have it or they won't get sober. And the doctor said, are you trying to sell them, convince them of a spiritual experience? Absolutely won't work. No drunk ever got converted to a spiritual experience. He said, I don't know what the alcoholics are almost impossible to deal with because you can't advise them. You can't talk to them. And he had to kind of paraphrase what one of his writings. Alcoholics are people who seem to have a clear plastic shield around them all over. And you talk to them, and they go, boom, boom, boom. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that information. Boom, boom, boom. He says, and I don't have any answer for it. If I did, our hospital would be turning out sober people, and we're not. We're training out drunken people again. We do the best we can. I don't know what the hell the answer would be. He said, maybe one thing. He said, maybe if you talk to these guys and told them that you understand how they feel and what having a few drinks does for you, apparently it does something special. I don't know what it does because I'm not an alcoholic, but maybe you can explain to them that you know. And there's a... maybe that you know how they feel when they try to quit drinking. They try to explain it to me. I don't understand it. But if you could talk to somebody and really try to get them to understand that you know how they feel. And Bill said, I can't imagine that working on anybody. That's ridiculous. He said, but I'll try it. Nothing else is working. So he got home, and there was a letter for him from a group of Wall Street impresarios saying that, gee, Bill, we noticed you've been sober for 6 months now, And just based on the old days when you were really pretty good, before that drinking got a hold of you, we got a deal out in Akron where we got to go take charge of this machine, rubber machine tool company. We've got to buy up the proxies, and we need somebody who knows what they're doing. Would you like to go out there? And if you do carry off this deal, we'll make you president of the company, and you and your wife will be on easy street from then on. But if you fail, don't even bother coming back. That just means you just fooled us one more time. So Bill went out there, as we all know from our book, had a story. Whole deal blew up in his face, wasn't his fault. Standing in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel on a hot May morning. And he reached his pocket, had a $10 bill. He could either pay his hotel bill or buy a train ticket back to Los Angeles or New York. And he's just so depressed. Go back to New York and be treated with contempt again. But I have to go back there because Lois is there. I don't know what to do. I should pay my hotel bill, but some years ago, I stood in that lobby and I tried to recreate that feeling he must have had. I couldn't because I wasn't anywhere near as desperate. But as he wrote later, I was trying to relive it. It's that later on turned into an old folks home, so I'll probably fit in more now. But anyway, over here is a room, I mean a door, and over the door is a curved little yellow neon sign that says cocktails. And he says, as he stood there burdened with doubt and fear, he heard music and the clinking of glasses coming out of that door. And he had a feeling that I'm sure 90% of the people in this room would have. If I just had a couple of drinks, I could think of an answer to this problem. And he started to go, and every step he took, this meeting started to disappear. But out of the corner of his eye, across the lobby, there's some payphones. You don't see much anymore. If you're young, you may have never seen one. But never mind what I just texted. Well, yeah. Payphones. And over the payphones, they used to have in small town hotels, the leading churches with the ministers' names and their phone numbers. So old Bill, that you remember he'd promised his friends in the Oxford group that he wouldn't do anything drastic until he talked to someone else in the Oxford group. So he laboriously went over there and picked up the phone, put a nickel in, that's what they cost then, and dialed the first number. And usually I get a little further in my talk. Well, shit, I can't do it. Anyway, he dialed the first number. He said, my name is Bill Wilson, I'm a rum hound from New York. I got to find somebody in the Oxford group. And the man said, I'm sorry, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm trying to write a sermon. Please don't bother me. And he called the next number, and nobody answered. And he called the next number, and nobody answered. But this isn't in our book. I heard this from old-timers in Akron who revel in it. And he called the next guy. He said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. I don't know. I don't know anybody. Hung up. Now, I don't know about you, but if I'd have been in Bill Wilson's boots, you know what I'd have said? Well, I did what I said I would. I did the best I could. And there would be no AA. But he noticed the last name on there, Walter Tunk. Jesus, I should get rejected by Walter Tunk before I do anything more. So he called Walter Tunk, who turned out to be the only man in Akron who could have helped him. One of the great miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, funny you should call. I have a parishioner, a wealthy lady in West Akron, who was telling me just yesterday that in her Oxford group they have a doctor who admitted he was a drunkard this week, and they've been praying for him, but nothing helps. Perhaps I could get in touch with her, and she could have the doctor come and talk to you. He said, fine. So he said, you wait in that phone booth. So the minister called Miss Parisher on West Akron. She said, yes. Oh, that would be nice. Let me get a hold of the doctor and see if I can reach him. I'll call you back. So she called the doctor. And the phone rang and rang and rang. And just hanging up, voice said, hello, I'm sorry. I was in the yard. This is Mrs. Smith. What can I do for you? She explained the story. She said, could this man talk to your husband? She said, well, yes, I want him to talk to my husband, but my husband's laying drunk, passed out on the floor now, and he probably couldn't answer back. But maybe we could set up a deal tomorrow. And the woman said, yes, bring him out to my mansion in West Akron. Bring him out, and we'll get a hold of this fellow from New York and have him come out, and maybe we could set up a deal. So the next day, which happened to be Mother's Day in 1935, the doctor and his wife and their two children went out there. They had to take the two children because he was too drunk and hungover to drive, and his wife couldn't drive, so their 16-year-old son had to drive, who later, by the way, I don't know if anybody was at the International Convention in New Orleans in 1980, they introduced him and said, we're very fortunate tonight, we have Dr. Bob's son. And everybody jumped up and cheered and yelled. And then it turned out he was an Al-Anon. All the spotlights. But he was a good Al-Anon. One of his alcoholic wives died, and he married another one just to stay in the program. But he was a good friend to me. I was a good friend, pretty good friend of his, and we talked a lot. He always talks about that trip going out there to this home, driving his dad, sitting in the back seat. All the way out there, his dad said, and I'll give this guy 10 minutes because I've spoiled Mother's Day for you. But I'm not going to sit and listen to any more damn lectures about my drinking. I'm sick of talking, hearing people talk about my drinking. I'll go out there for 10 minutes, and I'm going to do this because I love you, but damn it. You know, and kid. So they get out there, and this drunken doctor meets this highbinder from New York, and they sit down and have a bite to eat. Then they go off in a side room for their 10 minutes, and we're in there for 4 hours. And came out, and the doctor went to his wife and said, my God, Ann, I can't believe it. That's the first man I ever heard of who seems to know how I feel and why I drink and what a few drinks does for me and how bad I feel when I quit drinking. My God, he said, I can't believe it. He said, Bill, we had such a good talk. You think you might stay out here a couple of weeks and just talk a little bit more? And Bill thought, I have nowhere to get out of town. I can stop. So they stayed and talked for 2 weeks about the Oxford group and the spiritual values therein and how the doctor could increase his life and the spiritual values of sobriety. And the doctor just blossomed. And after 2 weeks, he said to Bill, I want you to stay with my wife and kids this weekend. The National American Medical Association meeting is being held in New Jersey. I was there last year in Atlantic City, and I was so drunk, and they ridiculed me and laughed at me and treated me like a dirt. And I'll go there this year, and I'll show them something. I'll show them something. And I'll be home Tuesday night, and by God, we've got something. So Bill stayed with his wife. Tuesday, phone rang. Mrs. Smith answered the phone. Woman on the phone said, this is Dr. Bob's office nurse. I am so sorry to tell you this, Mrs. Smith, but they carried the doctor off the train today so drunk he couldn't walk. And the station agent knew I worked for him, so she called me. And I came down, cab driver and I, we have him on the floor of the room, his office, and he's crying and he feels so sorry. And Mrs. Smith said, well, so sorry too. Mr. Wilson and I will be down to get him. So they went down and picked up this drunken, crying fool and took him home. I don't know very many things in my experience that I hate worse than a sorrowful drunk. Jesus.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Now you're sorry. Boom. You know. But they got him home and put him to bed. Great experiment. Went to hell. What went wrong? Don't know. Thursday morning, Dr. Bob sat up. What day is it? It's Thursday, Bob. I said, oh my God, I've got to do a cancer surgery. And I can't. Look at my hand. I've postponed it twice. They'll take my license this time. I can't do it. What can I do? So they got him up and bathed him. And his new friend Bill bought him some beer to steady his hand. He went off to the hospital. I'll be home about 2 o'clock, and I'm sure it'll go all right. So they waited for him. At 2 o'clock, he didn't come. And 3 o'clock, he didn't come. And 4 o'clock, he didn't come. And 5 o'clock. Everybody knew the son of a bitch is drunk again somewhere. 6 o'clock, the door burst open. Here he comes in the door, cold sober. He said, boy, I'm home. I feel great. I said, where you been, Bob? He said, well, I was doing that surgery. I got thinking about how in the Oxford group they want us to make amends. And I never thought amends should have to be made by a doctor, because we're far above that. But then I realized I'm a human being first and foremost. So I've been all afternoon making amends all over Akron. And I feel wonderful. And that was June 10th, 1935, which we contemplate as the birthday of Alcoholics Anonymous, because neither one of them ever drank again after that. But they didn't know they were founding a birthday of anything. Just, you're sober again? But they realized one thing. Sitting talking about spirituality had not kept Dr. Bob sober, nor had it kept the people sober in New York. What had helped Bill was trying to help people and talking to them in their language. So at that time, you couldn't, we talked about this at lunch today, at that time you couldn't get into a hospital as a drunkard. You had to have something wrong, maybe wrong in your digestive system or your appendix or something. But you're drunk, go die in the street. So Dr. Bob had a nun up there at the hospital, a nurse, that he knew well enough to call her up, Sister Ignatia. Now, I want to give you a sidebar here. I can't guarantee that this actually happened, but I think it did. I went to the 1960 International Convention, and I heard Sister Ignatia talk. And I went up afterwards and thanked her and kissed her on the cheek. Then I said, oh, is it okay to kiss a nun? And I think she said, as long as you don't get in the habit. I mean, that's 50 years ago. I can't remember every little thing. But anyway, she called up Sister Ignatia, and Sister Ignatia said, yeah, we have a guy here who's in here for some gastrointestinal upset, but he's a drunkard. He's a lawyer downtown. He's a lawyer from Louisville who moved here to get away from drinking. Of course, got worse when he got here. And maybe you could talk to him. I'll get in touch with his wife and see if she can set it up. And I heard him talk years ago. His name was Bill D. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. And my wife came to me and said, two men want to talk to you about your drinking. And I said, absolutely not. I am not talking to anyone else about my drinking. I'm sick of talking to people about my drinking. It makes me want to puke. Don't ever bring it up again. But my wife is a rather strong woman. So I talked to those two fellas. And they never talked about my drinking once. They talked about their drinking and how they felt. I never heard anybody describe me like that before. I was terribly impressed. So impressed that I've stuck with him ever since. And he became the third one in the chain. Then they got, this is again another sidebar. They went around Akron. They didn't get a lot of people, you know, because what you had to do, you take them to the Oxford group where they talk about Jesus for an hour, and they expected that would keep you sober, but it never did, obviously. But it offset what they knew. And they, I remember in 1963 or thereabouts, I was been sober about 5 years, and I was in New York on a project to go, had to go back to Los Angeles. And I had the afternoon off, it was late morning. I think I'll go up and see Bill Wilson. That'll be fun. It was on the 44th Street Clubhouse at that time, 44th Street office. And I went up there and said, I want to see Bill Wilson. She said, oh, he's booked for 3 weeks in advance. You know, I can get you in 3 weeks if you want to do that. I said, oh, no, never mind. And I went off in the archives and nosed around. And all of a sudden, here comes Bill Wilson. He said, are you the young man who wanted to see me? I said, yes, sir. He said, come on to my office. By 11 o'clock, didn't show up. So we went to his office and we talked for an hour. And do you know what he said? I don't remember. I was more concerned what he thought about me. The only thing I remember is a question I asked him. I said, Bill, in the book, when you first wrote the book, you know, you talk about all how you should talk to alcoholics and how you should identify with them and how you should do these things, but you never talk about taking them to meetings. In California, we take people to meetings after a meeting. Didn't you want to take people to meetings? He said, young man, when I wrote that, there were no meetings. Scary. You just had to go one-to-one. So anyway, they got a young guy who was about 29, and they said, you probably can't be an alcoholic, you're only 29, but you drink awfully bad, come on with us anyway. So we got involved with him, and he fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. Is that remarkable? He brought our organization, small as it was, our first relationship. I don't know a word that sends a shiver down a sponsor's spine like that one. I want to talk to you about my new relationship. Oh, Jesus. But he really fell in love with her, and they got married. That happened in my family as well. My youngest daughter, Susan, fell in love with some guy named Tom, you know, Tom N. And he was 5 years sober. And I was dead set against the marriage, but I have all daughters, and they all know much more than I do. So I want to tell you the absolute epitome of mixed emotions. It's standing, watching your daughter go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything because you're bound by the... You can give little hints. Let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. So they told him, you know, now you're married now. You stay home and take care of your wife. We'll take care of wandering the streets looking for drunks. You stay home and take care of your wife and give her a home. They didn't realize that apparently he was an alcoholic and he couldn't do that. And he got drunk and turned her against AA for 50 years. But anyway, little by little they grew. But the basic thing was always the same, that what makes Alcoholics Anonymous work is not that it has any great wisdom in here that's nowhere else. There are many books who have much wisdom as AA. There have been some wonderful people in 4,000 years of written history of alcoholism of our type. And everybody's taken a crack at the alcoholics. Psychiatrists and doctors and lawyers and religious people and popes and everybody. What is it? What's the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous? Why should its a flavor permeate what nothing else does. One word, identification. Identification gets through that wall. Not always to be accepted, but it gets through the wall. And I'm sure not very many people in this room haven't had that flash where you think, my God, he seems to know how I feel. My God, what a surprise. And so the story of Alcoholics Anonymous has always been predicated on the fact that when he wrote the traditions in 1948, he wrote that tradition, and he made a point of saying that we carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers, because that is what we have to offer here. What we have to offer here is a doorway through that hideous killing wall. In America today, many, many, many times more alcoholics die than get sober. In fact, I'm at a job today where I see alcoholics die every week. People don't look much different than you, except they used to, not anymore they don't. And they may die from, their liver gives out. They may fall on the sidewalk in a convulsion and smash their head open. They may overdose on crack. They may do any number of things. When I walk around my building in the morning, I'm always glad to see some of them still alive, because I'll tell you, it's a lethal thing. And I think, just think, what's the difference between them and me? I allowed someone to talk to me and get through a hole in my armor after 10 years of slipping, and I knew all about AA. I knew all about AA. I could talk about AA with anybody. But I just didn't believe it because I had the universal alcoholic problem. But you don't understand. My case is different. And with the moment you break that a little bit, the answer's there. So I guess you understand. That's why they keep nagging us about singleness of purpose. One of the great examples of that, let me tell you. In 1957, there was a guy in Los Angeles, an alcoholic, but he also had a gambling problem. And he'd bring his fellow gamblers to AA and figure out they'll get an understanding. And nobody ever did. I don't want to hear those juicers talk. Screw them, yeah. So he wrote to New York and became the first person to ever be allowed to use the 12 steps outside of AA. And he founded Gamblers Anonymous. And about a year later in North Hollywood, there was a guy, two guys actually, who were trying to take their narcotics addict friends in AA. Oh man, chill out. I don't want to hear that shit, man. So he wrote to New York and got permission to use the 12 steps and founded Narcotics Anonymous. And then the year after that, out in the marina where I live, some kind of semi-wealthy people wrote to New York and founded Cocaine Anonymous. And then in the Mid-Wilshire District, 2 years later, they formed Overeaters Anonymous, which are the big four now. And we were always glad to see them. I didn't know what the hell they were talking about, really. But when I was about 2 years sober, I had no front teeth, but I was staying sober for the first time. And I talked every opportunity. Here's how I feel about that. We don't care. You know. And I was trying to talk about obsessions at a club one day. I was talking about obsessions. I'm an authority on obsessions. Not the recovery from them, just the obsessions. And I was talking about obsessions, and this rather kind of nice, plump lady came up and she said, I've never heard anyone talk about that before. Could you come and talk to our ladies at Overeaters Anonymous this Sunday at Christ the King Church on Olympic Boulevard? I said, sure. I weighed about 128 pounds. I thought, I'll give them something to shoot at. So I went over there to eat. Eight kind of fat women sitting in the room. Well, don't. All right, they weren't. They were all skinny, scrawny. That make you feel better? They just went there to gloat. But anyway, and I gave a nice talk at Obsessions, and I know I had them because I did. And then I sat down. I thought, well, they're helped now. But then they had a little sharing session, and I could not believe my ears. A woman over here had a little boy, 9 years old. He went to a military academy down in Long Beach. On his birthday the other day, he'd sent her husband down to get him, and she took out the birthday cake and took one little piece, and then another little piece. By the time they got back, she'd eaten the whole cake, and she felt so guilty and ashamed. And I didn't say anything, because I'm a nice man. But I felt like saying, why don't you just eat one piece and let it go out there? What the hell's wrong with you? You know. Woman over here, ice cream fanatic. She couldn't wait for her husband, a surgeon, to go to work in the morning to get down to Rite Aid drugs. And take it home. And she had to find ways to get rid of all these boxes and packages. And I didn't say anything because I'm a nice man. But I wanted to say, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. You know. But a woman over here was my favorite. She ate till she couldn't eat anymore. Then she put her finger down her throat and vomited it up so she could eat some more. And I didn't say anything, but I wanted to say, don't bother shaking hands. If you slimy fingers. You know. Now, what is the difference? I understood intellectually exactly what they were talking about. But food didn't do that for me. There was no identification. It's just a weird behavior pattern. And that's what you got to remember when you try to sell your alcoholism to your folks. They want to understand, but they don't. And then you give them a long talk and they say dumb things like, you can't even have a glass of wine at Christmas? No, of course not. I just told you that. But that's why you have to be kind to your loved ones and assume they're not going to know unless they've had the experience. But what we have to offer here is this. Some percentage of alcoholics, maybe 10, get empowered by alcohol. The unnatural effect that makes an alcoholic is that it has to do something special for me that it doesn't do for them. But I didn't do that for them, and I didn't ever do it did something special for me. But when a man who I trusted and believed told me about it, I thought, my God, so that's it. And that's why you do the things here. You go to meetings, you talk to people. Because in the last analysis, we sometimes forget this. It's a good thing you bring this up on your anniversary, folks up in the half measures balcony. I don't know why I'm never invited back anymore. I try to be nice. But here's what you want to remember. Alcoholics Anonymous, with all its size, I belong to a big meeting in Los Angeles, about twice as big. And it's same service, same happiness, same thrill, same action, same involvement. And they use some of our stuff for start this meeting, as they should, because AA is made up of pockets of enthusiasm here and there, followed by waves of apathy. And it sounds funny, except the people who go to the waves of apathy don't stay sober. They die. But if you're lucky enough to be in a meeting like this, you keep coming here and you do the things and you get a sponsor. Because the fact is always constant. No matter how big AA is, no matter where you meet, no matter what it's all about, all of the service structure, what the hell it is, AA in its last analysis is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different at least enough so that he will take an action he does not yet believe in. When that moment comes, that's the ember of sobriety. Then you better blow on it. And you surround yourself by people going the same direction. And eventually you keep doing the little things and pretty soon you get a little fire going in your gut. Sometimes people say to me, because I was such a long-term slipper and I was such a loser, they say, how can you possibly stay sober so long? You were the worst loser of all. And here I am, 54 years sober now. Yeah, if AA was the idea of getting dry, I'd burst into flame up here. But that's not the goal. The goal of Alcoholics Anonymous is to do something that nothing else has ever known about. to very slowly through steps and involvements and actions and sharing and sponsoring to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to change my perception of reality, to allow me to live in the world with some degree of self-confidence, to take care of the people I love, to take care of my job, to come here and share with you. And remember, that's all the same story. Happy anniversary.
Alcoholic, my name is Dayton, and I was the chairperson in 2003. Thank you, Clancy, for giving a great AA talk. In the spirit of Rule 62, which is not to take ourselves too seriously, it is our custom on our anniversary night to have an entertainment spot. Please help me welcome Gina, Brooke, Kristen, Avi, Avery, Margaret, and Joe, who will sing Atlantic Group Island.
Yeah, for Avi.
Yeah.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale about a meeting called AG.
We're an awesome home group in New York City.
When speaking at the podium, men wear a suit and tie.
It's certainly better than getting drunk and high.
It's good to call other drunks. Please give us a shout.
And if they don't call you back, you can always write it out.
Always write it out. Always write it out.
To get a good commitment, very soon you will see.
You have to be a steering committee sponsee.
When you are new, there's no need to be bored. Go do some service.
Do you think I'll get an award?
She only wants an award. Go speak at a psych ward.
Stick around. Have a watch for your first year.
Always does wonders when you are in fear.
We're off to find fellowship at 60th and Park.
With Avi and Maggie too. Gina and Kristen. Avery. Me and Joe on guitars here at AGI.
Here at AGI.
Who will win the lottery for the grapevine?
Don't forget to thank the speaker and wait on that long line.
Wait on that long line. Wait on that long line.
The meetings are too short. You can't get sober in an hour.
That's not enough time to find a higher power.
Find a higher power.
Find a higher power. Seeking will slip away, that's my prediction.
That's her prediction. That's her prediction.
service is like having
sex.
You get what you give back.
Just talk to Peggy. That girl's got your back.
We're here every Tuesday. Well, sure, you'll get a smile.
The greeters will shake your hand when you're walking down the aisle. No more drunkenness, no more debauchery.
Today we all get to live
happy.
Joyous
and free. Happy, joyous, and free. Happy, joyous, and free. Happy, joyous, and free.
My name is Stephanie, and I'm alcoholic.